Alright, when you hear Toby Keith, you know that it's time for the Lynch and Kenny Hour. So I'm not sure how you really know that, but it sounded like something that would be okay to say. Joining me from Texas is Tim Lynch. Tim, what's going on?
Not much, Mac. Thanks for having me back on.
Always, always, always. And Jeff Kenny from Southern California. Jeff, a little bit of rain in the Garden of Eden today. How are you doing? You survive it all right?
Yeah, we're keeping our head above water. It's like Lejeune here the last couple weeks.
I had Gunnar Galinas record something with me today. And it was a battlefield study, but it's a battlefield. It's kind of the first one I've ever done with a PFC. Everybody I've ever done them with has been, you know, somebody who was in a leadership billet. And so it's kind of interesting to get, you know, just a PFC's perspective, everything from what it was like to go there by yourself as a PFC and head to, Bravo 1-9 is where I went. So flew into Dong Ha and then, joined Bravo 1-9 in the Khe Sanh vicinity. Before they went back up to Kantian. So it was kind of interesting, everything from the M16 to falling asleep on guard and going to Graves registration for a day and what that experience was like. So I got to thinking, really, in our conversations, when people hear it next week, you'll hear this concept of, and the reason why I want to talk about Kantian is because it is as close as we've come to peer-to-peer warfare in the last, you know, 50, you know, or so years. The first question I want to ask you is, where do you consider North Vietnam and in particular the North Vietnamese Army that the Marine Corps fought in the Northern Net of I Corps on a scale of peer-to-peer or near-peer? So where do you place them in that? And then the next question I want to ask you after we beat that up is, what breaks squelch for you? Both of you are well-read guys about Vietnam. Tim's dad and father, that tends to be the same person. Well, sometimes it is, sometimes it's not. But Tim's dad fought in Vietnam, and as did his uncle, and then Jeff is just knows a lot about everything. So, Timmy, let me kick it to you, because of your birthright. Where the North Vietnamese Army that was fighting in and around the DMZ and south of the DMZ in 1967, 1968, and 1969, where do you place them on the near peer or peer spectrum?
On a scale of 1 to 10, I'd put them on an 8. They had very, very good small unit leadership, and they were very proficient with their weapons. What they lacked was the ability, and really I don't think anybody can do this that well except for us. They didn't have enough artillery, enough communications and command and control to once they've committed to a plan, to adjust and shift that. And that's how come we were able to basically, in a series of battalion minus fights, destroy an entire division up there, the 9th Division. But they were very, very proficient, and they were not afraid to get in close and close with you. They didn't back down a second.
All right, Jeff.
Yeah, I'd put them up even higher than that, and I'll tell you why. They had been fighting since the Japanese occupation of Indochina, and they had always been fighting somebody who gave them a rough challenge, but never really decimated them all through their fighting with the French. So they always learned, you know, and what Tim says is absolutely true. All this stuff we talk about, you know, trust tactics and you know, commander's intent, they did it because they had to do it, because they didn't have the technology to you know, to be connected in. And so things like what we were experimenting with, which we basically got from them, like at you know, at Quantico, is the Yankee defense, all kind of like registered gun positions where everything down to the aiming stakes is in. The only thing that's missing is the gun itself, because they didn't have a lot of that. So they shift that stuff around, in order to put fire on places they mean to assault. They do it pretty good, considering there's very little comm. The way they approach it, their field craft, these are not, and the average North Vietnamese soldier, there's a book called about cohesion that we got, seemed like I got it issued to me when I got to Quantico on the instructor staff at the basic school. It was cohesion, and it was about the North Vietnamese and a couple other forces. But I remember about them, they weren't really jungle men. The jungle was that type of environment there in the DMZ was as alien to them as it was to most Americans. These are city people from Hanoi and Haiphong and stuff like that. But they all, they bought right into it. And being able to do these fights, knowing the intent, made those casualties so high, particularly for the Marines in the northern part of South Vietnam. And particularly around there, when you consider the sustained heavy bombing, we're talking strategic bombers regularly pounding their, a guy who's coming from an assembly area in the, in the middle part of Vietnam and moving down south, his life's constantly in danger. Because unlike the cities and the built up areas, which we didn't really bomb, not really until the Christmas time of 1972 in any appreciable way, they were bombing the hell out of those places. And so those guys were resilient, and very well suited to the war. And they gave us a run for our money that I think rivals the North Korean Army, the Chinese, and maybe even the Japanese.
And I'll pile on to that because they do it with essentially no air cover, with us operating, not as permissive as we have in the Middle East, but over Northern I Corps, pretty permissive environment. And so they did it under those conditions up near the DMZ. We could not find their artillery that was north of the DMZ, right? Tim, I think last week, was talking about their ability to put all their indirect fire assets on the reverse slopes of terrain features, and they learned how to fight us. And I'll tell you what, when you look at the casualty numbers, the numbers are amazing. Let me just read to you indirect fire. Indirect fire in Northern I Corps in Klan Tien in September of 67, the People's Army of Vietnam, which is the NVA, started their major shelling of the base, hitting it at least 200 artillery and mortar rounds daily, peaking on 25 September when they shot 1,200 rounds and hit the base. From 19 to 27 September, more than 3,000 rounds hit the base. In response, Marine artillery fired 12,500 rounds. Naval ships fired 6,148 rounds. And there were 5,200 Marine sorties and Air Force sorties against that. And they take all of it and they keep closing with it. It's amazing. And then I want to read one more of these to you. This is 1968, I believe. 21 July. It deals with a bunker system. That's not. I got to find the one that says. All right. So in 1968, there's sightings. I want to say this is August of 68. So this is after Tet. There's sightings of enemy tanks by Marine fighter pilots and aerial observers, right? They also reported spotting trucks, right? Truck parks, camouflage revetments, storage bunkers, and trench line. Of special interest was the repeated sighting of low altitude, slow moving lights during hours of darkness, which it was assumed came from enemy helicopters thought to be resupplying forward positions with high priority cargo such as ammunition and medical supplies, or conducting medevacs. On 19 August, after 60 arc light strikes, 2nd Battalion 1st Marines assaulted into 3 LZs into the southern part of the DMZ. 60 arc light strikes after artillery prep, right? Are you shitting me? I want to read you one more thing that gives you some idea of their ability to endure and improvise. And we ain't going away, boys and girls. This is 1968, again, after Tet. On 21 July, 2-9 discovered NVA bunker complex 6 kilometers southwest of Compiègne. Okay? Southwest. Right? So they're already beyond Compiègne, composed of 60 A-frame timbered bunkers built into the sides of bomb craters, each with an average overhead cover of 10 feet thick. The system connected to a large command bunker by a network of interconnecting tunnels. The command bunker featured an aperture overlooking Compiègne and Charlie 2, and documents found in the bunker indicated that the NVA had been observing and reporting the movements of helicopters, tanks, and trucks entering and leaving Compiègne and C2. Now, to me, the more I read about these guys, about the NVA, that's pretty good, man. That's pretty good. And so, you cannot help but be impressed with their fighting abilities, given our firepower and our aerial, superiority, and their ability to first of all conceal and camouflage what they had, and consistently get it on with all the units that fought in the northern part of I Corps.
Well, they're convinced that they're going to, make the American public so appalled with the casualties that we would pull out, and that didn't really happen. In the way they wanted to.
Well,
they
had to part of the story, though. Right? It was part of the story, though, right? I mean, that was part of the story. Timmy?
Well, no, I was going to say, but you can admire how tenacious the NVA was, but you can also you can wonder about our own command and control, because my dad will tell you, and I don't know if he included it in the LZ Margo thing, he reported helicopters after LZ Margo when they pushed up further to the west. He reported helicopters, and they thought they were going to get attacked by tanks. They think they were prime movers moving artillery out of the way, but they set up for a tank attack. They reported helicopters. The headquarters came back and said, no, you're seeing the aircraft carriers at Yankee Station. And the old man's like, they don't have lights on during night. It was an Army officer, yeah. Army headquarters he's talking to. He's like, they don't have lights on. That's over the horizon. He stopped talking to him. He goes, okay, fine. But they were definitely moving helicopters up there. And when they were told, he was told he can't report helicopters. So he goes, we see lights going up, moving horizontally and coming back down. But they still would never do anything about that or never acknowledge the helicopters.
Wow. Yeah. Wow. All right. Yeah. The interesting stuff. All right. So when you think of that's focused on the NVA, but both of you all are both you two are well read about this. So I mean, we would call it peer to peer. Yes, I would. I mean, they may not have had the aviation to contest that space, but you know what? It didn't slow them down a whole lot. So to me,
classify them as peer to peer.
Right.
I mean, it's true they didn't have the ability to do offensive CAS, offensive close air support or deep air support or anything like that. But they did use those. MiGs were shot down, in an integrated air defense, which was peerless that they had up there defending, correct, their high value targets up there in North Vietnam. I mean, between the service to air missiles and the anti-aircraft weapons that they had it locked up. I mean, that's basically where, the core instruction that goes on at the weapons training instructor course out there in Yuma for air started from. How do you crack that nut? I mean, everything from those guys who are doing the Thud Ridge strikes, and the stuff is all because of how good that their stuff was.
And not only that, but the Marines at the time considered them to be peers. I mean, when you start reading the accounts of from the individual riflemen, and I got that Road of 10,000 Pains based on your interview last week back, and I'm enjoying the hell out of it. But the guys that are going out there, they knew damn well the NVA could hand them their ass. And what's amazing is they never, I have never read of any unit hesitating to get it back out there. I know there's always going to be some individuals who shirt something. There always will be. Yeah,
right.
But there was never any hesitation to get out there and start mixing it up with those guys.
Yeah, but another thing that hurt them, that area you're talking about, 68, 69. They suffered massive casualties during the Tet Offensive, and then in the April, May, June time frame, another gutload of massive casualties, not just them, but the Viet Cong also. And so consequently, they filled in down south a lot of the battle spaces and stuff in a coin type environment that the VC used to have. They were less effective because they weren't from there.
Right.
So that took away from the, it could have been worse.
No, it's kind of it's interesting. I want to say the Westmoreland decides it's October of 68 that there were, instead of the Maginot Line that was, and I say Maginot Line to spare the use of my own last name up on the DMZ, but the McNamara line, I found this really cool map that I put in the Gunnar Galinas battlefield study, but it's really cool. It has all the combat bases. It has and it has the larger bases, right? The 3rd Marine Division at Dong Ha, the base at Quang Tri, and then all the, whether it be company or platoon, bases, from Khe San to Kalu to Camp Carroll to the Rock Pile to Charlie, 3 Alpha, Charlie 2 Alpha, all that stuff. There's even the cleared trace of that clearing that, you know, we got bulldozers online and bulldoze that. So that map's included in there. So and then all the, AOs, Scotland, Lancaster, Osceola, Kentucky, Napoleon, all the named battle spaces are there. So it's pretty cool, little map. And then you see Contien sits right in the middle on a piece of ground that dominates, right? All the way to the coast and all the way across the DMZ. And right. So it's a pretty interesting place. Now, with all the reading that each one of you have done, Timmy, you can go first again. What breaks squelch for you in your reading about this peer-to-peer fight that went on in 1967 through really 67 and 68 up in the Contien vicinity, and Jeff mentioned earlier that, you know, it moves then, you know, to the Oshawa, Dewey Canyon and things like that. So, but around Contien, what breaks squelch for you in terms of your reading and your study?
Well, from my perspective, looking back, you know, in the 70s, 80s, 90s, there were lots of books about Oshawa Valley, about Way, about Contien and et cetera. But it was very difficult to put it all together. You know, I knew about what happened with 1-9 because I was in 1-9. So I could understand a little bit about that. But what breaks squelch with me now as I've read, read about it for 30 years or so, is that the Marines actually knew what the hell they were doing. You wouldn't know that if you just read some of the firsthand accounts of these battles where these guys are going in there, you know, such as Buffalo when Bravo 1-9 goes down that meeting in contact. And not every operation was done well, and not every combat leader and every battalion's is squared away. But they had a good idea of who they were fighting against. They knew exactly who they were fighting against, and they kicked those guys' asses. I mean, they kicked their asses every time they started concentrating in the Leatherneck Square area. Cause as Jeff pointed out, the NVA, they're very good of doing logistics push. So the last thing that shows up are the dudes. That everything gets put ahead of them, and then the fighters come in last. And as soon as they came in, falling on the gear, I mean, they did that well. They could get in and set up pretty well, but once they were discovered, their asses were hammered. And they were hammered by rifle companies going against battalion. It's fucking amazing when you look at it.
Yep.
From that level. Yeah.
Jeff, how about what break, in your mind, what breaks squelch? And Timmy, let me just comment. I mean, some of the stuff that they discovered, I read about just that one trench line, but when, after the 60 arc lights, right? And they went up there, they found a trench system, right? And it was unbelievable. 2-1 swept the area, found no evidence of its use by helicopters, right? And then it talks about, what they did find. It was amazing. It's a fully developed trench system, right? With thousands of rounds of, HE for indirect fire, medical facilities, food, as you guys both just said, everything staged and ready, right? For the line companies to come in. You know, grab what they need and get it on. And what, you know, in the book, what is it? The book I read by the guy who fought, Sorrow of Tears or something like that. The guy Bao Nin, who's in that documentary, he talked about the fatalist attitude of the soldiers because, you know, when your battalion got blown away, right, they took you. For instance, if you didn't close with the Americans quick enough and you got caught, you got annihilated by napalm, HE, and, I mean, you got burned. Guys got burned. You know, you had a significant number of your battalion getting burned alive, right? And then they would go back to these re-education camps. They'd get more guys, and then they were coming back. And they had this fatalistic attitude, like nobody's going to get out alive. And so Bao Nin writes that he left North Vietnam with his battalion of 500. Five of those guys went back home.
Jeez.
Exactly. It was pretty amazing. And then you just stayed down there. You just stayed down there and fought. And so
that's a guy whose mother didn't want to admit that he survived. Right. Nobody else's did.
Right. Yeah, because all the other families hated her and called her kid a coward.
Oh, man. It's unbelievable.
Yeah, what?
It's hard to imagine that kind of fighting.
Right. You know? For us, I mean, it's almost inconceivable, right, that you're going to go down there and you're going to fight till we win this war. And so if it means you're going to go down there and die, then you're going to go down there and die. But it's for Ho Chi Minh, it's for Vietnam, and this is how we do it. But it is astounding, and I just wanted to make the point about how good they were at logistics with all the AV. I mean, you're talking about them moving all that stuff at night. Right, and then having a plan to conceal it while we're all over the skies. So it's pretty amazing.
Yeah, I mean, that's a big joke at the time. You know, North Vietnamese 40-year-old lady gets three 82 millimeter mortar rounds. She carries them for 3 weeks down to down an area off of basically the Quang Tri province. You know, after coming in through the Ho Chi Minh Trail and walking in, you know, at night the whole time. She drops off the 382 rounds, and the dude says, "Okay, now go back and get three more." And and so people who weren't even combatants, you know, basically, and if you see them from the air, you know, you see two or three people walking, you're like, "Yeah, there's three people walking." You know, you're not gonna waste a bomb on that. You know, you're not gonna waste much as the movies like to make, you're not gonna swoop down if you're in a helicopter and machine gun three people just moving. You know, it's like they definitely dedicated. On the other hand, though, you had a lot of people who became Kit Carson scouts, who became Chu Hoi, you know, who actually worked for the Americans and didn't switch sides again. You know, who had must have been highly dedicated at one point, and then became pretty effective for us. You know,
talk about all right, Jeff. So when you think of, you know, these battles. What breaks squelch for you?
Well, I think the original intent was to try and pull U.S. forces up into this big area where you could make it a World War One type, you know, bloodbath, and that the Americans would lose heart. And by 1960, late 67, that just wasn't happening. I mean, they were content to leave the Marines up there in appalling conditions. The combat was bad enough, but you had the Marines' uniforms and boots rotting off them up in that area in the northern, by the DMZ. They just weren't reacting. And that led to the, we'll have this mass assault over every population center, you know, in, South Vietnam. And what that did is it destroyed their counterinsurgency dudes. It destroyed the Viet Cong,
right,
that doing it. So I thought that's a credit to the Marine Corps and the Army units that were up there, like the Air Cav, and also Special Forces detachments that were up, like, for instance, the guys at Lang V and a couple other places,
right,
who, you know, were using these non-Vietnamese minority folks, like the Nung tribesmen and the Hmong and stuff like
right,
that,
right,
using them, and they're teeing off against the MVA. So it's a credit to that. This strange mixture of, it's not like the fighting in the Philippines or in Okinawa World War II, but it has its own flavor, and it's a mixture of peer to peer fighting with all that sundry, counterinsurgency stuff also.
All those different layers.
Yeah.
That are mixed in with it. I'll ask you kind of a theme question. Were Kantian and Kaesan, were those big fights? Were those staged in order to draw American forces away from cities in South Vietnam? Or there's a pretty robust debate about that, you know, among historians. I just wonder what your thoughts are.
Well, it's real common it seemed to be for the longest time people would point to that as again showing just how clueless we were. And,
right,
and granted, we certainly were taken surprise by Tet. I'm not buying that. I think they were making legitimate grabs at those guys. I think they were making a legitimate grab at the guys at Kantian too. And and who knows? Because if you look at the more recent history, if you look at from the 80s and the 90s, it was, you know, Giap was trying to recreate a Dinh Van Phu. If you look at recent history, we know that Giap was sick in somewhere in Eastern Europe. I mean, he wasn't even running the goddamn war back then.
Right. Right.
So and we didn't even know that at the time, you know.
Yeah.
But I think they made legitimate grabs at those places, and I think they got their asses kicked hard.
Yeah, Westmoreland's reaction to the buildup at Kaesan was he put a minimal. I mean, we had 6,000 Marines in the Kaesan area, you know, facing anywhere from 15,000 to almost 30,000 MVA, and the idea was we're going to let technology do most of the killing. Unfortunately, and it did probably do most of the killing. Unfortunately, though, the peer-to-peer stuff was vicious. I mean, we talked before about, you know, Bravo 126, talked about the guys on the hill fights that were surrounding Kaesan, right, you know, the stuff that India 326, huge, fights that have no comparison through any of the subsequent combat we had, you know, in Desert Shield, Desert Storm. Or
Marlantis was wrapped up in all that. That was all up in Northern Iroquois too.
Yep. He's up there by the Laotian border for sure. You know, 1-4 I think.
The Gunnar Galinas talks about carrying dead bodies for days before you could medevac them, and just the physically grueling nature of the terrain. If you look at the map of El Zimargo, if you look at that battlefield study that I did with General Lynch, you look at the terrain. I mean, shit, you're mountain fighting.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, so imagine the mountains in the northern end of Camp Pendleton. Imagine them, you know, with the double canopy jungle on it. and humid and over 100 degrees. And you're humping your shit up and down those mountains chasing, trying to find these guys. And then when you find them, right, you bring in close air and you blast away a hole with napalm so you can see them and you can, you know, you can HE the shit out of them and all the rest of that stuff.
That book by Charles R. Anderson, The Grunts, which came out in the early 80s, he does the best descriptions of not so much the combat, which are good, but it wasn't so much, they had a couple of sharp combat instances during Operation Virginia Ridge, was the operation he's describing. But like his quote was, endless humping through superheated hills.
Right.
And, you know, that was like a soul breaker in itself. Just hauling all the stuff you needed to survive up and down these hills, you know, in 100% humidity, you know, over 105 degrees, wearing all your shit, not eating a good, you know, meal, not getting, your requisite number of sleep at night, a misery on earth.
I've got one to add to that one too. The old man was telling me, because we were talking about this before we came on. I was chatting up my dad, and he was telling me that shortly after Margo, you know, because what they had ultimately overrun was a gigantic hospital and a logistics complex, and they had also overrun some 152 artillery. That was the time he thought he was going to get. A few nights later, when they heard the armor, it turned out that they were moving artillery out of the way, but they overran all the ammo. So they call up, they go, yeah, we got like 300 rounds of this 152 ammo. And they're like, we want you to all bring that shit back. And the old man's like, the LZ's like 3 miles away. You've got to be shitting me. No, we want that stuff back. You know why they want it back, right? It's a brass casing. So
fast forward.
They humped the shit. They spent a day in relays. He rests the company while two companies are humping back. They're getting an order. They're getting mortared the whole time. And then that night he gets a call from Keys, the division, like, where the hell's the brass? And he goes, what are you talking about? I put it on a helicopter. And apparently in between where he was and Keys, it got stolen. And the old man's in D.C. like years later talking to some other guy. And he walks in his office and he sees this 152 brass. He goes, hey, where'd you get that? He goes, yeah, it came off the DMZ back in 68. So, and the old man's like, geez, son of a. Yeah. And it was that bullshit, too. So it's not just humping out bodies. It's humping back brass because you know that the general's going to take home. Oh, my God. That would have pissed me off.
Yeah. You know? I mean, at least they were given, like, if you're a Marine, you couldn't take an AK-47 home, but you could take an SKS home if you got it. You know, if you shot a guy and you got his SKS, you could keep it, you know, all the way through that thing. And then they changed the rules so that, yeah, guys were fighting in Grenada, you know, and then later on in Desert Storm, they couldn't have, never, if you got caught with anything, your ass is grass.
No, let me just say, I just think, you know, if you're interested in peer-to-peer warfare, right, do some reading about Kontian and those fights there. I mean, they were manly events, okay? They were manly events in every sense of the word. You had an enemy that would close with you. You had the terrain that was horrible. You had the elements that were against you, whether you got, it was the rain up in Kontian and the heat, you know, on that flat plateau or that kind of rolling plateau, or, you know, you were part of the hill fights and lived that miserable existence. So, pretty sobering. And dare I say, the casualty numbers are jaw dropping. You know, some of these fights. And again, I go back to General Van Riper a couple weeks ago talking about, you know, he
47, something
74 of his Marines were KIA, and over 100% of his Marines were casualties, either KIA or WIA, as they rotated through. And so.
Now that brings up something interesting. Okay, so you're young Lieutenant Van Riper, you're rolling out there, you get in with 1-4. And I'm going back to that road of 10,000 pains, and in that book there's a picture of a guy. He's got a 60 mortar. He's got the mortar sitting inside his helmet, and he's got his utility cap folded up, and so the ball's sitting on the bill, And these guys are saying every time they left the line, they stripped all the increments off the rounds, never took a base plate or a bipod. They just would put that thing and just start pumping out rounds that way. Now, how do you, as Lieutenant Van Riper coming in, how would you square that one? Because that's it. Because I'm fascinated by this.
You know, my NCRC in Iran, Gunny Stepp was the 0341. He was a 60 mortar. He was with Charlie 15 when they rescued Howard and the platoon of recon guys off the hill in 66. And this was at night, and they lost their fucking, whoever it is who had the base plate for the 60, they couldn't find him. So they used their helmet. He used the helmet to put rounds out, on that hill to get up there. And, but he didn't do it. It never occurred to me to even ask. And he sure as hell said the reason they did that is because they couldn't find the base plate because it was pitch black, noise everywhere. You know, every once in a while, you know, you'd have a loom go up. But, you know, that's why he did that. I heard it from other guys too about the, but it was always, I always heard it was like an emergency thing, you know?
This guy says that's where they left the wire, and so how do you square that with if you're coming in as a brand new lieutenant? That to me would be interesting.
I asked my dad. FB-24 to me has that handheld plate, that little plate.
This is a moot point. I'm going back to what Van Riper was talking about.
Right. But somebody thought it was a good idea to have a.
And what you've got is you've got your knowledge of what you know is discipline and what a unit should be and whatnot, and you're butting up against front specific knowledge of guys who are like, no sir, around here, trust me on this shit. We leave the increments behind. We come out. I don't think I would have gone down with that. I would have said, oh fuck no, we're taking the bipod. No, come on, you'll be shitting me. You know what I mean? I just wonder how you square some of that information.
Well, I'll tell you what. I mean, I don't know how you all did it, but. My philosophy, well, whenever I, you know, go to someplace new, whether it's sea duty or whatever, like, look, no orders change. I'm joining you. You're not joining me. All right. So my job is to learn what goes on here. When I have a question, somebody better have a good answer. And if it's not a good answer or we sit down and I don't think it's a good enough answer, you're going to get the first chance to unfuck it. All right. And then if you can't do it or you get stumped, then I'll get involved in it. Okay. But that's how this is going to work. So to me, I mean, that's what you do, right? Look, you guys have been risking your lives every day going out and do this. I want to see how this gets employed. Show it to me. And if it doesn't break, it doesn't pass muster, then we're going to find a better way or a more sound way of doing it. And you can have first crack on that too. But the bottom line is we're supposed to be good. And if it makes sense, then it makes sense. I'm all about it. So I don't know.
It comes back to how the Marines presented himself to you. He got the shit bag and he sounds like he doesn't know what he's talking about. He'll be like, yeah, right. No, that's how you would. I agree. That's exactly how you go and crack that nut. Yeah. I just find little things like that interesting. You know, little shortcuts like that.
I mean, like the adjustments they made to our basic infantry weapons during the 80s reflected the fact that there was good ideas that, you know, took hold that were not doctrinal.
Right.
For instance, the fact that on the M224 60 mortar, you have that you have a trigger to shoot it from the handheld mode and a special base plate to do it.
Right.
And then when the M60, you know, the unfortunate thing was the first time we saw the new M60 was Rambo shooting it from his hip, you know. But we got a lighter M60, which was good, you know. I mean, in some ways it wasn't as good as the old one as far as stability goes, but people made it work. I was the last company in the 2nd Marine Division when we went to Liberia to still have M60s in 96. And they were outstanding. We used them from the tripod, but we were prepared to not use them from the tripod if that was the case.
Right.
You know?
Well, you know, we all know about what the Japanese did with their knee mortar, right?
Yeah.
Right, and how deadly
they never shot it from their knee, but yeah, exactly.
Right. Well, we know how it's applied, but so I mean, the ability to get it into action quickly to, yep, you know, to walk rounds on to somebody, you know, all counted. And so, so mm-hmm. interesting. No, I'm like you guys are. I'm very intrigued by that. And to me, part of it's credibility. Now, I don't know if I would have changed and called bullshit on it, if I was zipping people up into bags and I wasn't just, you know, moving around 29 Palms or Camp Pendleton, or which gives you a lot more latitude in terms of I can give you more leash because it's not a sense of, it's not so urgent. I don't know if I would have had as much leash out, were I Lieutenant or Captain Van Riper and we were, you know, playing You Bet Your Life. I'll tell you what I probably would have done. I'd probably sat down and said, hey, look, I'm not good with this. And we need to, before we go out again, you need to show me this. And before we leave the water, I probably would have sat down and had a very pointed discussion with them about it. I would have probably negotiated like, okay, look, we're at least going to take one base plate out. We're going to take one whole system out, you know? And so, you know, so we can, I respect what you're saying, all right? I respect what you're saying, but I got to see it for me to bet somebody else's life on it, okay? Somebody else's life, so.
And then you, and
I think that's hard.
You know, exactly. Your battalion goes out, and you may be expected to be able to put out rounds to support another company, and he may be further away than you can shoot with only one increment on the fucking mortar round. So you better have your base plate. You better have your shit. You better, you know, because there's more than just you out there. You know, I mean, that's how you win. You know, I mean, so I mean, the you need to take your gear for sure.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm with you. As much as I enjoy, you know, the discussion, pretty serious decision when all of a sudden you run into a situation where you left your capability behind for less than a great reason. And so it better be a great reason and it better be valid. So interesting. Now, let me just tell you, in this whole discussion of peer-to-peer war, I bumped, you know, I don't know what I read about Kantian, and then I started reading more and it was the Battle of Gitlin's Corner. Mm-hmm. That battlefield study. And, you know, you just in that, which happens about this time. So Gitlin's Corner happens, I don't know how many clicks, southwest of Kantian. And India 3-9 is doing a movement to Kantian, essentially up there looking for trouble. They're it's part of Operation Prairie 3 or 4. And, you know, I want to say Prairie 2, they killed like 1,200 NVA soldiers. And so they go back up there and then, you know, the NVA watches them the whole time. Hell, they could have been watching them from that bunker for all I know. And then when the three platoons moved out to set in their platoon size, ambushes, they let them get approximately a click away where they knew they could interdict them and keep them. And then they tried to overrun the company CP. And that's where all that fighting took place. But it was in listening to Jack Riley. It was in listening to General Neill, that I heard, you know, the way that the NVA fought and the battles that were going on and the numbers of casualties and whatnot. I was like, holy shit. And so then this whole peer-to-peer thing, started going and got me more interested. So it's interesting that Timmy, what are you doing? Are you moving your microphone? Are you breathing into it? What are you doing?
No. I got a little too close to the microphone. Sorry.
Oh, really? You sounded like a dragon in your lair.
I wasn't paying attention. I didn't even mean to.
Are you falling asleep with your mouth over your microphone?
I was looking. I got like three screens. I was looking for something, and I wasn't paying attention. My mistake.
All right. All right. Let's. All right. We got about 15 more minutes. Open mic. Tim, you've been going first all night, so anything you want to throw to the group, and we'll kick it around?
No, not really, not off the top of my head. I'm just enjoying reading the things about Kantian, and I read this one that's what I was looking for when I started breathing on the mic. I was reading it's one account of just one of the obscure little fights, right? where a Huey gets shot down, and the pilots they crash land on the deck. The pilots get out. They set their M60s off up. They're the only officers on the deck, and they go from call sign deadlock to deadlock on the deck and start running Cass Air and Snape, Snake and Nape and stuff. I just think those kind of little stories like that are just hysterical. They're priceless. You know?
Yeah, like Stephen Pless, Marine, yep. Huey pilot at the Medal of Honor, trying to rescue Army dudes on the bank of a river in 67. I think, you ever read about that guy? Stephen Pless.
No, I haven't. I have not.
Yeah, he got the Medal of Honor. I mean, there was a gunship, a Huey gunship. So him as co-pilot, a gunny and a lance corporal as gunners who operate, and they had a shitload of rats. They come on these guys being bayoneted by either Viet Cong or NVA, and so they swoop in on them, and they rescue the guys. And the bird is, like, bouncing off the river, as they're going up the river looking at – they say, if we crash, we want to crash in the river, so the guys they had the lance corporal and the gunny jumping out of the bird to rescue these guys who were wounded and get them on the bird, like three of them, I think. So they way overloaded. And they had shot up a bunch of a bunch of enemy soldiers, and Pless got the Medal of Honor, and his co-pilot got the Navy Cross, as did I think the gunny and Silver Star for the Lance Corporal, but all of them wounded too, including Pless. But then he was killed. He became instructor in Pensacola, and he was killed jumping his motorcycle over. I guess I'd never been to Pensacola, but I guess they have canals much like Chappaquiddick, I guess, And he was jumping his motorcycle from one to another. And he crashed and got killed like a year later.
Wow.
Yeah.
Oh, man.
I will tell you one of the things that, in just the reading that I've done, and somebody sent me an email after the show today about where would you start. I would tell you, those green Vietnam books that Marine Corps put out? Start
with
that. They're in PDF format. They have great detail in them. They have great maps. Right. And then I would say that should serve as your baseline. Now you can say, well, the Marine Corps, blah, 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 blah. Look, it's a good baseline. And then go from there.
It's very good.
Yeah. And I would, the other thing I tell you is, you see some pictures. In the Battle of Cantien that will straight up stop you. There's a picture of dead Marines stacked on the back of a tank.
Right.
That is, they're Bravo 19 Marines and,
David Douglas Duncan.
And man, I'll tell you what, you see that picture and you look at it and you're like, holy shit. And so to me, again, and I always bring it back to this whole idea of peer-to-peer combat. And this whole idea of what discipline is and what discipline is not. And so I just think it's pretty interesting stuff. It's pretty sobering stuff. And I think you'll get cured of whatever issue about discipline that you have as soon as you read this for a little bit. Because let me tell you what, if there is a requirement for, that bleeds out of peer-to-peer war, it is, you better have your shit in one sock going there, because if you don't, somebody will rip your head off.
Yeah.
In a big way, not in a small way, in a big way. And so it's really, really, really sobering, really interesting. And the images, as I just said, especially this image of Bravo 19 Marines during Operation Buffalo being brought back.
Is that the one where the company commander's name is Slater?
I don't know. I just saw the photo.
My commander boot camp was a guy named Curd, and he was, I think, he was Alpha Company, I think, 19 for Operation Buffalo. And the regimental commander was a guy, Colonel Wilder, who was the 3-3 CO in the first Quezon fights in 1967. Kind of ironic. I didn't know it till, later on when I'm a PFC, I'm reading those books you're talking about, Mac, and there it is. 19 Marines in Vietnam, 1967. Gary Wilder, Marines in Vietnam, 1967. James Curd, and I'm like, holy fuck, it's those old bastards,
But, yeah. The other thing Gunnar Glean has talked about was, getting handed the M16 and just watching it break down. And, in fact, there's the picture of the dead Marines on, and I don't know how many there are on top of this tank. There might be, you know.
I've seen that picture.
There might be 20 bodies, it looks like, on the back end of a tank. And there's a Marine walking by it, and he's got an M16, and you can see there's no forward assist on it. And, they talk about, you know, just, you know, how brutal. I asked him if there, I said, you know,
the ammo was fucked up too. They had the wrong ammo.
It was the powder that screwed them.
And the powder was getting expended directly into the chamber.
It was an arbitrary adjustment that the Army made on the cartridge that for feet per second that ended up fouling the entire system. It's the most bullshit story you ever if you go down that rabbit hole. It's disgusting. Yeah.
Well, I asked him if there was any, I remember getting to the fleet, right, and we're getting ready for an IG inspection. And so, you know, you do all the inspecting, and then, two or three days, the last time you come out of the field, right, and you're going to give the weapons their final cleanings, right? Right, mm-hmm. and your staff sergeant says, hey, Lieutenant, you need to go to the gym or go find something to do for the next 5 hours.
She's going to use WD-40 and fucking
break free, whatever they could use, right? So I asked Galinas, I said, so was there a workaround? Because most time Marines are pretty good at, you know, at getting around that stuff. And he said, no, there wasn't. There wasn't. And nothing we could do. The only thing you could do is, you know, get really good at somebody had a rod, you know, put together and, you know, you had to punch your bore. And then you started shooting again. Holy shit, man.
Yeah.
Holy shit. He said, no. He said, can you imagine swapping out rifles like that in the middle of a war? You know, and then can you imagine? Can you imagine if that happened today?
Yeah, on Earth.
What's that?
I mean, the most wealthy country on Earth.
Yeah. Yeah. Stupid.
Your guys are fighting with, and it's not a bad weapon if it's done right, you know, but I mean, what kind of patriotism put that shit out, you know?
Yeah, I'm not exactly sure about what kind of. I mean, in the middle of a conflict, we're gonna swap out lines of ammunition. We're gonna swap out all that shit. Come on,
yeah.
Well, they were sending battalions up to the DMZ with nothing but laws, and where there was actually North Vietnamese armor up there that might come down and grab at you. And the old man said they had, I guess it was a 2.75 rocket launcher. He refused to turn them in. As long as there was ammunition in the system, he kept his. But he said most people wouldn't.
Yeah, the rocket, the 3.5 is what we had then. But the one, you're right, Tim, the one before was the bazooka. That's a 2.75.
Right.
I mean, that's what you saw in the Saving Private Ryan.
Yeah,
we had
right,
those
yeah,
in Vietnam. Yeah. I mean, the 3.5 is a good piece of gear. You know,
said take out bunkers, take out tanks.
Yeah.
He said the law was shit, wouldn't do anything.
Yeah, if it worked, it would, but it's only 66 millimeter. You know, so
yeah,
it's like,
exactly.
And then it's an armor piercer. So you shoot at a bunker, I mean, it's like shooting, it's just, you're right, you know, it's like, you know, it's just shitty.
There's a guy who, named Frank McCauley in the Bravo movie, Common Men, Uncommon Valor. Who talks about when they did the payback attack. And listen to this. Galinas, he initially is with Bravo 1-9, okay? Then they're in the vicinity of Khe Sanh. And I want to say they get into a fight on...
Well, 1-9 was one of the battalions of Khe Sanh.
Right,
so
and so they're at... I think he was at Hill 881, right? So he's involved in those Hill fights. Then they go to Khon Tien. Then he gets sent to Bravo 126.
Wow.
Yeah, he knows Ken Pipes. But he got there. I said, well, were you there for the payback attack? He said, no. He said, I got it. I got there after. He said, those dudes were tough, man. They were still pissed off about the fact that their comrades laid out there for a month before they could get them.
Yeah.
He said they were not good with that, even after I joined them. But, you know, one of the stories that this guy is telling in the documentary is somebody shoots a law at an NVA soldier who was like, he was out of the trench taking a piss, and he sees the Marines coming and takes off running. Somebody shoots a law at him. He said, hits him right in the back. And he said, it literally, so the shape charge, right? it blows the hole right through his. He said you could see through the hole. You could see through the hole. Yeah, and then he goes down, and you're sitting there listening to it, and you're like, "That's a pretty good law shot right there, man."
Yeah.
But yeah, pretty interesting. All right, boys. First of all, thank you for doing this. Any final thoughts, Tim? Final thought.
Hey, Mac Hastings wrote a Vietnam book. It came out last year, and that also, as far as one comprehensive book, that's well worth the time to read.
Wow.
Yeah, wow. And he goes back on a lot of things he reported earlier. There's a lot of going back and correcting a historical record.
So well, like that stuff with Jeff.
Being, yeah, it is a good book.
Yeah. Jeff, final thought.
Well, I was going to talk about the tension with Iran and how it's being manifested with our guys in Iraq, or you know, and I would comment on that and saying, no good deed goes unpunished. I mean, that whole thing with the, with the almost like a detente thing with Iran that was tried with the last administration basically led to, it's just a coincidence, this thing called ISIS pops up and they are unstoppable going, you know, through Syria and Iraq. I mean, and obviously, you know, financed and, supported by Sunni Muslim people. You know, from the Saudi places and stuff like that. And now here it is, you know, we're nose to nose with these guys. And Iraq is highly, highly dangerous place because the forces we have there are in a very vulnerable position. I just was going to say, you know, that's open source stuff too. There's nothing secret about that.
Got it. Yeah. No, it's been kind of interesting to watch, to watch that. And you know, one of the things I think is that, you know what? Iran is, you play exactly the game they want to play when you fight their proxies. And to me, we broke and squelch on that. We're beyond that, right?
I think you're right. That's what I was going to say.
Right. So if you're going to do that there, guess what we're going to do, you know, at Chabahar or Bandar Abbas or one of your ports.
Yeah, there is key terrain in this situation for sure.
Right, and you don't need to go to Tehran. You don't need to go to Tehran. And so to me, we should be very blunt with them. Say, look, we're not going to fuck around with you guys anymore in a different part of the world. If you think we're going to allow you to continue to destabilize the entire region and then not pay any price for it, other than some bullshit casualties that you'll suffer well forward, you're wrong. We're going to bring it home to you, right? And it's going to hurt. And so if you want to fuck around like this and, you know, you fuck with the bull, you get the horns. And so but you know what? It's really interesting. I have a guy named, I don't know if you guys, either one of you know him, but his name's Grant Newsham. And he's an intel guy, worked out in the Pacific. But he's made me smart about
I heard the podcast with him.
Yeah, you know, and so it's like, we can have a deal. We just have to get on our knees and prostrate ourselves, and they'll give us the deal that they want. Do you want a deal? But whether it be with China or North Korea, right, if we stand up on our hind legs and say these are the conditions, right, what they'll do is they'll just play it sideways, hoping for regime change in the United States and hoping you get Joe Biden say, you know, the Chinese, come on, we can do business with them.
Yeah.
And so when you look at the Chinese and you say, and this is kind of interesting, when you look at the Chinese and say, hey, one, stop forced technological transfer, right? And two, right, stop intellectual property theft. Those two things, you've got to come to the table of developed nations and you've got to stop doing that. Well, what does that mean for the Chinese economy? What does that mean for the Chinese system? It's like Jimmy Carter going around the world saying human rights, human rights, human rights to communist countries.
Yeah.
Well, guess what? We can't fucking do human rights in a communist country, Carter. Didn't you learn anything other than fucking science and engineering at the Naval Academy? Did anybody teach you shit? That if we do that, it means the end of us. So, so to me, the confrontations with China, the confrontations with Iran, are exactly that, and we can't shy away from them. And again, I had somebody look at me like I was fucking crazy when I said Barack Obama was one of the weakest presidents of the United States this nation has ever known.
It's true.
And they looked at me like, what?
I said, it seems to me like they must, I mean, they must have been drunk. Because I can't, I mean, you know, the whole thing with the, you know, the you know, with the money for them and all that stuff and the, it was just, awful. And then, you know, not standing up to their ally Syria when the guy's gassing his own people. When you say you're going to do it, you know, the Sunni people, you know, the people of Yemen who are Sunni, you know, biggies, people in Saudi Arabia, people in Pakistan are like, hey, what can we do? You know, how can we? And then up pops ISIS, and they march right all the way to almost to Baghdad. You know.
Yeah.
I'll tell you something else. I always listen to Grant Newsom. I love it when you have him on, and he's the first guy to say, and I was glad to hear him say it because I wasn't sure that nobody's ever stood up to China or Iran before. He was saying, hey, look. This is the first time we've actually called a spade, and what are they going to do? You know, that's sort of like the argument about the shooting of an aircraft carrier with a hypersonic missile. Go ahead, take out an aircraft carrier. Now you know what's happening next. I mean, what do you think's going to happen?
Put your earplugs in. Mean?
Yeah, exactly. So now it's like, okay, boys, we're not playing. So what are you going to do? You want to play trade war with us? We've got an
economy.
Well,
you know, one thing I neglected to say, the big first thing we did wrong was – you know, people think Iran is an iron monolith. China is an iron monolith.
No.
No. There's problems in Iran. Right. In 2009, I mean, it was very dangerous. With a little bit of help, what do? We back them up. And, you know, the people they had in Iran who were, like, bucking for a little bit more say in the government, they got squashed.
You want to hear my war plan for Iran?
Yeah.
All right. Sure. Here's my war plan. So, first of all, their air forces might be a little bit more formidable, but they're just another addition of Iraq, right? So we get our shit over there, right? And then we jump, we land, we put people ashore for one purpose, to get them to concentrate someplace.
Right.
And
so they're vulnerable.
Right. So we annihilate the Republican Guards. Right, we annihilate every bit, every ship, every airplane. We annihilate them, and then we tell the people, "Hey, take it over." Right, yeah. And then we leave. You guys fight it out,
and that's the most important part. Then we leave. We don't get involved in a nasty counterinsurgency phase four bullshit. You bought it, you broke it, crap that you know that Colin Powell used to love to say. Yeah. And all of a sudden, we become responsible for these people who. You know, who did abominable things. We had to attack them and kick their ass. Now you got to help them until they're on their feet. Go fuck yourself, man.
No way. Well, no, and then leave them with this. Look, if we're going to leave you to yourselves, right, but we're going to supervise this thing. If we don't like what we see, anytime you stack two bricks on top of them, each other, we'll knock it down. And we can do that forever.
So, exactly. Tom, hey, look.
So
we're
good luck.
Treat you like a state in America once we beat you.
Right.
We're gonna treat you the way Sherman treated Georgia. A crow chronic flying across Iran is gonna have to bring his lunch.
So that's my war plan. Is you destroy it all and you land enough people, enough soldiers and Marines, and you move on something that forces the Republican Guards to show their asses, and you annihilate, you make that highway to hell north of Kuwait City, you make that look like Disneyland. That was just a carnival compared to what's going to happen to those son of a bitches.
But then what happens, man? What happened with the highway of hell? People started seeing those pictures, and what did the press start doing? Oh, hey, we better knock this off. We're kind of like beating up on these guys. Oh, geez, we're sort of kicking their ass a little too hard.
No, we're not. You know, no.
That's
no.
What happened then?
No,
and
they
went and thumped out. We'd never be able to get a beer in Europe again. None of us.
All right, boys.
Well, those Europeans are some whores, Timmy. You know we could still go back there.
Oh, no.
God bless them for it, man.
They're whore. Talk about the most spineless place you've ever seen. Germany, really? Come on, man. Can you even defend your own country? I can answer that. No. Right. Well, it depends Sweden, who attacks it.
Sweden and the Danes are standing up. Amazing.
Right. You know? Right. The Germans can defend their country if the Yazis attack them. Right. Anybody else? They don't have a fucking chance.
Yeah.
All right, boys. Have a great week. We'll talk to you next week.
Right. See you later, Max.
See you later, brother. All right, man. Have a nice one.
There you have it. The Lynch and Kenny hour or so here on a. I don't even know how long we go when we do these things here on a Thursday edition of All Marine Radio. So don't touch that dial. More of this program coming up next here on your home for it, the All Warrior Radio Network.